Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today it's my pleasure and honor to have as my guest Dame Antonia Byatt. She is the author, most recently, of A Whistling Woman, but it's a peculiar circumstance. It's a kind of completion to a quartet of books that investigates the nature, in a sense, of completeness. The books began with The Virgin in the Garden, followed by Still Life, by Babel Tower, and now A Whistling Woman, published by Knopf, is the final book in the series. Now, for me, as I was rereading all the books are haunted by the death of a child, which comes in its most intense version in this book, where so many of the children we now see are bearing the consequences of witnessing almost supernatural cruelties. And people haven't really spoken about this because there's so much cognitive and metaphorical subject matter in the book, and yet the pain of a child seems to run through all the books, whether it's Marcus's breakdown in the first book or the terrible witnessing two or three times over in the course of the book of a parent who kills the family. And I wondered about that because it seems like the wound that generates some of this thought.
Some of this is personal because my son was killed between one moment and the next by a car in the week of his 11th birthday. And I had largely finished The Virgin in the Garden. And in fact, I had planned that Still Life should end with a what I thought of as a literary presentation of the experience of an accidental death. And the worst possible accidental death that could happen happened to me. And I did think, shall I go on? Can I do this? And in the end, I thought, well, it's all in my head and I have to do something with it. So I did do it. The deaths of the family who are killed by the father in A Whistling Woman, I had thought of, in fact, before that. It comes out of two things in my own life. One is there was a dreadful episode in the 50s of a British father who walked his whole family out into the sea and drowned them because he knew that nuclear war was coming. And he didn't wish them to live to experience it. He was so taken with the terror of the possibility of nuclear war that he thought they were all better to be cleanly dead and drowned them. Behind that is my own father, who was a good Quaker and a barrister and became dreadfully distressed by the existence of capital punishment in our country as it then was. And I put the two plots together, really. I had a religious father who killed his family out of kindness because he had a vision that told him to do so. And I then had the surviving child in the position of, because he happened not to be there at the time, having further to undergo the way in which the law then set about killing his father. And his father wouldn't plead that he was mad. He said he wasn't mad. God had told him to do it. And in those days, he would have been hanged. And in my book, he is hanged. But the blackness of execution and the blackness of a loss of a child, in some curious way, have always been wound in my mind. And also the blackness of the experience of anybody remotely connected to an execution.
Well, in Still Life, the second book, there's a woman, a mother, who's killed her children, and her husband is afraid of her, afraid of seeing her now. So it's sort of a subject that continually haunts the book and receives its kind of metaphoric presentation in Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, which becomes one of the subjects of parents, children, and faith in the final book, A Whistling Woman. But it seemed to me to be always, as I read the quartet, an eerie, a howling, a supernatural element, because the books are not by and large concerned with the extremes of life, but in a kind of intelligent life, how to preserve it, how to maintain it, how it can be lived. And there are these crawling examples of things that interrupt life too completely for life to be sustained.
Well, anybody who is wise knows that any time we are given to think rationally or deeply or contemplatively is pure luck. I mean, we sit here in Santa Monica. I don't think it would be very easy, though it might just be possible to sit here and have this discussion in Afghanistan. But it certainly wouldn't be possible for me as a woman to be having this discussion. Civilization is a very delicate and rare and complex thing, and it needs looking after like a garden.
Well, order and disorder does seem to be at the root of the concerns in the quartet. My guest is A.S. Byatt. The most recent book is A Whistling Woman, but this is a quartet of books that concern a character, Frederica Potter. And when she starts, I have to tell you that The Virgin in the Garden is one of the central books for me. She's a young woman. She is reading literature, and she is discovering that the world, to some extent, has begun to revolve around her. She is playing Queen Elizabeth in a play, Astraea. It's to commence the second Elizabethan age. The second Queen Elizabeth was being coronated. This was the first television coronation, and so the theme of television entering and broadcasting culture begins in the first book, and the book culminates with an extraordinary scene where this young woman walks into a church presided over by her sister, married to the vicar. Sister is arranging the flowers, and she cries, "I can do anything! I've done it, and I can do anything!" What she's done is to do very well on her examinations, and yet it's an entirely empowering moment, and she is at the center of the mask of the new Elizabethan age. She is meeting younger writers. She is learning the work of older writers. She is learning about her sexual possibilities and hoping that she will not remain the virgin queen. And so she is in a world that has a center. And the books seem to be about how the center looses itself.
What I've been realizing since this book came out is how important it is to the form of these books that I actually thought of the idea in probably about 1962 or 1963. Frederica in the 1950s has the sense that the British briefly and fleetingly and almost in a dream had, that now the Second World War was over and the new Elizabethan age had come, civilization would return, people would be able to form ideas of what they wanted to do, and they would be able to do it. I am that bit too old to have felt empowered by the chaos that was brought by 1960s sense that you must break all boundaries, you must smash all windows, you must start an educational system which doesn't depend on order but depends on spontaneity. Babel Tower is very much about the French 60s in a way, which discovered the Marquis de Sade. And the Marquis de Sade, with complete rationality, said, you know, why should one of my desires be fulfilled and not another? You know, if I wish to do this or that, what sanction is there that says I should not do it? And if I wish to sort of seduce somebody and then kill them. And Sade is very, very frightening. But that's okay. Sade is Sade. What really interests me is the degree to which a great many serious thinkers in the 60s and the early 70s said he is actually the prophet for our times, including Simone de Beauvoir, who wrote about why we should not reject Sa'd. I think we should all know that Sa'd is there, but to take him as any kind of philosopher who is telling us how we should behave is a quite other matter. So he gets in too. The killing of children is one of his nice little themes.
Well, it seems also that...
And also there was The Lord of the Flies, of course, which came out on that turn of the 50s and the 60s. And that also depicted the coming of chaos and the death of children.
And the blank, I would as soon murder...
Sooner murder an infant in its cradle than nurse unacted desires. I mean, that was a mantra.
Yes, of that period.
Of that period.
And the revival of Blake. And throughout the book, there are artist figures who are sort of patron saints of the novels. In Still Life, it's Van Gogh. In The Virgin in the Garden, it's... Well, the narrator confesses that it's really Spencer, but Shakespeare is more handy. And in Babel Tower, it's a demiurge, it's Sa'd. In A Whistling Woman, it's a whole squadron of thought that's dividing and dividing. It seems as if what we learn in this book is the Lewis Carroll lesson that you can create a brilliant confusion by the constant doubling and the reappearance of different versions of the same themes. And so everything in this book has its double somewhere, not just in the book, but in one of the previous books. The book seems to be about learning to live with irresolution and how to structure irresolution.
I think that's the best way anybody's ever described it to me. That is exactly what it is about, and thank you. I suppose I learnt really during the writing of it that living with irresolution, constantly juggling connections and mirror images and an idea and bits of language that appear to be quite different in different contexts. There are words all over this novel which mean one thing to a Darwinian genetics expert and quite another thing to somebody in a religious cult. But some of the same words get in. And each of them is trying to put together in their mind a cosmos which is not only a reflection of their own desires. I think there are people whose cosmoses are only a reflection of their own desires, but as a writer, find them quite boring. I like people who try to make sense of things. And in many ways, the central character isn't either the religious leader of the cult, who is the damaged child whose father was a prophet, who grows up to be a prophet, or the rational male snail geneticist. I mean, it's the liberal vice-chancellor who has tried to make a university in which many explanations will constantly correct themselves against each other. He has tried to require his students to know both the sciences and the arts. He tries to hold a conference on the relationship of body and mind, which it's a conference on human nature. And it's interdisciplinary, and somebody comes from everywhere to talk about every possible aspect of this relationship. And his conference is invaded. And I have been saying for the last 25 years, the conference is going to be invaded by the forces of unreason. That was my shorthand for the anti-university, which is set up like the camps of Midian, round the edge of the university. The university is built on a campus on the North Yorkshire Moors, round the Elizabethan house in which Frederica played Queen Elizabeth on the lawns, in a sort of sense that there was going to be an order. And this house, this ordered house, has been put at the centre of a university with ordered towers representing all the disciplines, the language tower and the maths tower, all joined by walkways. The architecture is a symbol of order and construction. And the anti-university camps around in unhygienic tents and caravans and comes and puts stickers on the university. And the the Vice-Chancellor continues to be rational and just and noble and says we won't take down their stickers, those are a form of self-expression. Anyway, they'll put some more up. But in fact, he goes too far, being gentle and reasonable and liberal. And as a result, various things and people get smashed.
Now, one of the examples of the kinds of symmetrical thought that grow through these books can be found in the new book, A Whistling Woman, by my guest, A.S. Byatt, published by Knopf. There is a boy who has been hurt. He is to grow to be the prophet, and he has a wonderful Latin teacher who teaches him to find in words their history from other cultures. He exhibits the derivations of words that begin with X and EX. Then there is a boy, a younger boy, Leo, who has not been able to learn to read despite the fact that he is the son of Frederica, our heroine, who is perhaps one of the most ferociously literate heroines in modern literature. And he is taught to read by phonics. In other words, it's a system that will not allow him to gain access to the past of the language that he manages to learn to read. So he has the ability to read. It is a triumph and a very moving thing. Literacy is very moving in these books, but it's a kind of quasi-literacy, a literacy that doesn't admit to the shapings of civilization.
But if you haven't got the beginnings of literacy, you can't go on to learn derivations or epistemology. My own two elder children were little at a time when a method of teaching reading called look and say was very fashionable. And you were meant to do a kind of eidetic recognition of the word aeroplane, which was in fact quite easy because it's a long word and you remember its visual shape. But they didn't learn the basic structure of how to recognize any word fast enough to read a whole sentence. So they had access to nothing. One of them learned to read very quickly and very well, and the other one was in real trouble. And I was put on a government committee, which I agreed to be on in order to be able to be able to tell. Everything has its mirror image, and before comes after. And I went on the committee because I knew I wanted to write about how people acquire language. And the committee was arguing about the look and say teaching method, and it was arguing that phonics had to come back because some people can only learn to read with being taught the sounds. I remember as a very tiny child learning to read, and I hit a word I couldn't do, and I kept saying, Machine, Machine, and they said, no, it's machine. And with that, I did look, say. But mostly, I took such pleasure in the phonics. I don't think it excludes him. I think it enables him. And he's been excluded by kindness, asking him to run before he could walk.
But I'm thinking in particular of there's a very amusing reappearance of Mr. Potter, the father, in this book. He's given half the opportunity to fulminate, which is what he's done for the first two books. But he's been put in his place, in a sense, by the vicar, who says to him, no, your desire to see the Bible viewed as merely a literary text has created a situation where it's not viewed as anything at all, and therefore the literature which you do love cannot be understood. It's a very moving thing because the very last passage of the novel has one of the most famous sentences in all of literature in it. It's Milton's, the world was all before them. I was once, it's what is said when Adam and Eve are expelled from Eden.
Yeah.
I was once in a class with Hugh Kenner, who said, you know, if you don't know the Ode to a Nightingale and certain crucial passages of Milton, there are huge, vasty swatches of literature which will be incomprehensible to you. You will never know how to fit yourself into the workings
of a literary permanent mind rather than one exhibit or another. And it was so moving to me. These books really do say that unless the past is really committed to memory, it turns into unintegratable fragments.
Yes, I mean, this is what I feel very, very violently. And I love and admire Hugh Kenner. And I really do believe in the handing on of something that is both an immediate sensuous experience, like the rhythm of the Ode to the Nightingale or the rhythm of Milton. And I had a student once who had perfect pitch, and he said, you know, if you were walking around the mountain of paradise, you could hear a pentameter, and you would know if it was a Keats pentameter or a Milton pentameter. And this meant as much to him, though mostly he played in a rock group, as it meant to me. And we sort of sat there and thought about a pentameter. I spent a long time working out how to write the end of these four novels. And I knew that that one Miltonic sentence, the world was all before them, had indeed to come there. And it closes it, as you have rightly observed, because the Virgin in the Garden begins with the figure of the woman and the snake and the tree and the queen and the enclosed garden. In a sense, the university is still the enclosed garden. And at the end, both my snail man and Leo and Frederica are out on the wild moors, seeing a perfectly harmless conflagration, which is the gorse bursting into blossom. But I have to tell you something now, because it's quite frightening. I spent 2 or 3 days being very frightened of writing the end of this book, sitting by myself in a small house. And I had a dream. You know how you dream a poem in a dream? And I woke up in the middle of the night and wrote down the important thing is the iambic pentameter and the death of children. And I wrote this down on a piece of paper and went back to sleep again and looked at it in the morning. I thought, yeah, it is. It's the because, of course, the iambic pentameter, as somebody writing about Sylvia Plath once pointed out, represents the heartbeat and the pulse of the blood, i.e. it's life. And the death of children is wrong.
Now, what makes me astounded in the course of reading these books is that you feel their shape after you've completed each book. It's impossible, I think, for a reader to know where the book is going in its midst. And that's part of its theme, that there is constantly the need to integrate the new and see where it will take one, that it's not simply the conservative vision I'm suggesting, but rather a vision that sees everything as necessary. It is not the old at the expense of the new. It's that everything can be adduced and brought in. And this is Federica's concept of lamination, which is taken seriously in the first book, but by the end it's become a kind of, looked at as a kind of trendy thing. But I think your method is itself laminative.
It's partly laminative, but partly I secretly hope that the thing is more organic than lamination, because lamination is layers of something glued together that remain completely separate, whereas secretly I'm still co-origin. I believe a poem or a work of art grows like a plant, or as Milton said it did, and it has its roots in the earth, and from the root springs the green leaf, and then brighter the flower. And in a way, I have the two images of works of thought or works of art, the laminated and the growing, and the flower puts out all sorts of things, and it has its seeds and it has its structures and its endless forms of flower, and you will never know them all or see them all. The other thing I was thinking when you were talking a little bit back, you said there was a presiding artist in all the novels, and of course the presiding artist in A Whistling Woman is really the idea that television could have become an art form. And Frederica has this program in which she sits like a mermaid in a box or Alice in Wonderland, because the program is playing with the idea of Lewis Carroll and the Through the Looking Glass and the world on the other side, which is a world of illogic, which proves that logic is important. And in a way, nobody ever made the work of art that this wonderful medium was there to make, if anyone had been interested in it, which, as far as I know, nobody ever really was. There have been one or two good plays that were written for television rather than being small films or stage plays. But nobody's actually made a work of art which plays with the visual structures. So the work of art you have made out of television is what you put together in your head out of everything that batters you out of it, which does include Shakespeare, who goes across it from time to time. And in a way, that's where my book ended up going. And Frederica sits there like Alice, interrogating all these caterpillars and carpenters and things, saying, you know, what do you mean? What do you mean? One of my best friends, who is a professor of English and to whom Possession is dedicated, wrote me a lovely letter last week, and she said, the thing about Frederica, really, in the end, is that she's ordinary. And, of course, that is the other side of her. She's an ordinary woman who is just greedily curious. She isn't... I mean, she isn't Susan Sontag. She isn't Iris Murdoch. She's the sort of woman who can competently run a television show because she's very clever. But she doesn't make things.
I've been speaking to A.S. Byatt about some of the contexts that run through a recently completed and really kind of majestic and impressive quartet of novels, culminating in the new one, A Whistling Woman, published by Knopf. We are going to continue talking next week and see if we can begin to show how these structures come together in this fascinating novel. Thank you very much for joining me, Antonia.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. I've been speaking with A.S. Byatt, author, most recently, of A Whistling Woman. You can read the first chapter of A Whistling Woman on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistants from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book. Off the mouse, pop.